The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Derek Varn is a poet, teacher, and theorist. He currently lives in Cairo, Egypt, and has previously taught in South Korea and Northern Mexico. He is a lecturer in English literature, composition, and intercultural communication. Even though I've never met him in person, I consider Varn to be, at this point, an old friend. He is a reader at Zero Books and a regular guest on the Zero Squared podcast. This week, we return to discussing Russell Jacoby's Dialectic of Defeat and end up discussing the problem of political determinism. Political determinism is the one-sided idea that our political will, rather than economic necessity, shapes our world. An easy way to understand what political determinism is to consider conspiracy theories, or more accurately, the conspiracy theory of history. From the perspective of the deep conspiracy theorist, history is determined by willful acts. There is no such thing as an accident, and all plans work out as they are envisioned. If there are poor people in the world, it is because somebody, somewhere, wants it that way. The radical alternative to the conspiracy theory version of history is one which admits for unintended, but not a causal, consequences. It's Wednesday, November 24th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of Zero Squared and the publisher of Zero Books. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, I have two requests for you. The first is to ask you to check out Zero Books' new YouTube channel. Just search for Zero Books at YouTube to find it. Also, if you like this little show, you might leave a review at iTunes. And if you like the press, take a look at our website. Zero Books has 6 new titles coming in December. Slave States, This Space of Writing, Drone Apocalypse, Against Capitalist Education, Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism, and Positive Realism. These books make great holiday gifts for the grad student or communist in the family. Okay, so that was 3 requests. In this episode, you'll hear from Mr. Speedy Delivery, Mr. Rogers, a Walmart factory worker, and a clip from Sam Cooke's hit, Chain Gang. The music you're listening to right now is Dan Lett's Green Sharpie, but in just a moment you'll hear C. Derek Varn and I discuss political determinism. Do you think Jacoby is important to read at this moment?
Yes, and I think he's important to read at this moment for what he gets wrong as much as what he gets right. And, this is a chapter where we get closer to contemporary politics and where I think Jacoby is a little bit more muddled, partly because I think he was trying to connect two things that seemed connected but weren't, which was this development of sort of Western Marxism as academic Marxism and the reaction to Lukács, to a lesser degree the Frankfurt School, although it's important to him, and then to Sartre and some Malice, which was really interesting to me since the first chapter is basically an attack on Althusser, who's a Malice. And I don't know if it – like when this was written, which is in the late 70s, early 80s, people didn't know really in our circles how Malice-y Sartre was. people didn't know how problematic Lukács would be. No, I knew he knows that because he talks about it, but he doesn't really dig into it. It's a real problem. This chapter we specifically talk about, it's about the development of the left communist traditions specifically, and its relationship to the creation of Western Marxism, which I think Jacoby thinks is straightforward. I do not think it's straightforward, because there's a lot of problems in the concept of Western Marxism itself, in a lot of vaguenesses, and there's big chunks of history he doesn't get into. But one of the things he does talk about was how easy it was for the Comintern to kind of manipulate opposition groups within the Communist Party.
He starts out talking about how after the Russian Revolution, there was a sense in the Third International that Germany was going to have a revolution next, and that really the German communists were going to be the head of international communism. And when that fell apart, there was a split between Western Marxism and Orthodox Marxism.
And that split goes down the thing we talked about before, too, where the Western Marxists favored the phenomenology, the Eastern Marxists favored the science of logic, talked about their stuff as science. The Western Marxists were not as readily available to use that, talked a lot more about, you know, working class culture or hegemony or cultural hegemony or various forms of consciousness, be it worker consciousness or whatever. You know, this leads to standpoint epistemology, although he doesn't talk about that because in this book that hasn't even really happened yet, or was happening as this book was written. It leads to a lot of things. And he also talks about some of the disparate forms of reaction in 1968, but we're not there yet in this chapter. You know, his big people he mentions, of course, and then, you know, Luxembourg. Luxembourg is a big member of the German Revolution. The German Revolution gets put down. It gets put down hard. And part of that comes back into something he actually doesn't discuss very deeply, is how deep the splits between the Spartacists, who were the communists, and the Social Democrats, who were the old Marxist, and also Lasallians kind of together, really tore that up. But he does actually talk a lot about what happened with the left Hegelians and the PCI and the PSI in Italy, which is directly related to fascism, because a lot of the... He even says some of the better readers of Marx, Engels, and some of the people who criticize Engels were around Giovanni Gentile. It's part of my Italian. I don't speak it very well. They went with Mussolini into the fascist party. They also had a Sorolin strain to them, you know, about cultural myths being necessary to kind of revive working class culture. But one of the things he points out in this chapter that even left communists today miss is the council communists, who are kind of seen as bastions of left communism. They're mentioned by the Situationist. They're important to communization theory, and people like Gilles Devey. They had this obsession with working class culture, too, because they said that the peasantry didn't really exist and you couldn't pull on that the way the Bolsheviks had done and the Maoists had done. And you had this obsession with, like, proletarian culture to sort of break itself out of bourgeois consciousness and what that would look like. This also really animated fascism. And so when Western Marxism splits, it splits about four different ways. So you have those loyal to the Eastern Marxist. You have those kind of in the center, which included Trotsky at the time. You have people who kind of flirt with Western Marxist idea but are ultimately good Stalinists, such as Gramsci, although Jacoby doesn't talk about how Gramsci was still a Stalinist in this chapter or at all. And he also talks about Bordiga, who he kind of criticizes actually unfairly. And I don't remember if it's in this chapter or the next one.
One thing that I, just going back to Rosa Luxemburg, noticed was that I didn't find myself very excited about either side of the debate around the German Revolution. Like, Rosa Luxemburg was saying, oh, they need that there needed to be more of an understanding of the proletariat consciousness and the psychology of the proletariat, meeting them, and that the problem was the bureaucracy and the way the party replaced the proletariat's own subjectivity.
Right.
Which can easily be translated into you didn't respect their feels. That's where that kind of thinking ends up. The fact is that it's not very Marxist to talk about proletarian subjectivity that way.
Well, this is the great problem, like, that's plagued me. This time period, okay, is, and the groups that come out of this time period bring us back to this theme that you and I have been hitting on now as, like, one of the key breaking moments for Marxism that really hasn't even been truly understood to be as big as it is. You and I like to call it the bootstrap problem, you know, except what most people think about bootstraps problems, they think about it as individuals lifting themselves up by their own bootstraps. But what this comes to is how does the thought that thinks itself, to use the words of Donetskaya, which I don't like because it's convoluted, but she actually does try to get to this point a bit, come out of this, you know, where you can collectively lift yourself out of your own bootstraps. And really what Western communism tries to do is say, look, if things were inevitable like you said they were, we would have not lost 1918 in Germany. We did. The Leninists have, particularly, you know, in the 20s, which is what there's a lot of this is set, they kind of manipulate the communist groups against each other within the communist parties. Right? So Zinoviev is playing like center left communist against people more aligned with Stalin, and Bukharin against people who have become Trotskyists, kind of, and then set things up for like big marches in the 20s. When those fail, that they blame those people. They have them liquidated. Well, not liquidated, as in killed. They just have them kind of exiled from the Comintern. But as Stalin sort of creeps in and Zinoviev himself gets purged, a lot of these left communists are literally liquidated. They're just, you know, kidnapped, brought into Russia and killed. And a lot of people who were aligned with them are increasingly alienated from everybody. And the guy who I think is the most important and most misunderstood, and also is very important to the Frankfurt School, although he isn't a member because he's too early, is Karl Korsch, who's sort of, you know, second string member of the German Communist Party when a lot of this is going on. He also talks about the invariant school a little bit. And the Dutch Marxists who were councilists, but they get denounced in Lenin's left-wing communism. But in here you have the sort of turn to autonomism. But autonomism has the same flaw that you and I are kind of hitting on. If you think all you need to do is to valorize proletarian culture and like adopt it and quit trying to control the consciousness, then you're saying in some way that the proletarian's consciousness isn't altered by capital.
If you've read Capital, you know that the capitalist system degrades the consciousness of the working class and their bodies.
Whereas people from Lukács forward actually try to argue the opposite. Now, at least Gramsci tried to illegitimately admit, and again, I don't think that... No, Jacoby doesn't really go into this. This actually puts the Leninist against Marx. he writes an essay called, roughly entitled, it's not an exact title, but basically, the October Revolution versus Capital. And that's not versus capital as in capitalism, that's versus capital as in Das Kapital. Because he kind of thinks that there's a voluntarist element into that that sort of overcomes Marx's later pessimism. You know, Gramsci doesn't articulate the what we see in Althusser as like the hard schism between young and old Marx, but he's kind of hitting on that. And there are, whereas I don't buy the Althusserian crap anyway, I'm just go ahead and call it crap. I will say that there is some significance to the idea that there is at least a tension between a text like the Communist Manifesto and maybe Engels' writings with some of the determinism in Capital. And the only person that I think has really explored this in public and the kind of problems of it was Adorno. In that text Resignation, which we've talked about way too much. I think every one of our listeners now is probably sick of me talking about it. But where, you know, he talks about basically in the thesis on Feuerbach and in the 17th Brumaire that Marx is being more aspirational than realistic when he says that the purpose of philosophy is to understand the world, but we are to change it. And also the corresponding that to the thesis on Feuerbach that man can now take, you know, man collectively can now control his own history. And Adorno says, well, why don't they? And also, you know, from your own logic, we have to admit that if the bourgeois consciousness is corrupted by capitalism in some crucial way that, you know, goes beyond moral impulse, then so is the proletarian.
I mean, it's an important thing to ask here when you talk about corrupted consciousness is corrupted from what, you know?
Well, that's a good question. Marx isn't used the term corrupted. Marx uses the term, well,
Marx talks up when he talks about the working class, Marx just talks about how they became illiterate. You know, working classes became illiterate and they lost their skills as workers, too, as the machines came in. And, you know, first it was manufacturer that asked them to simplify what they were doing to just little, you know, parts of processes with tools. And then it became, now you're just working in service of the machine. And you know, you take the children and put them in the factories and take the women and put them in the factories and... you know, you're breaking up the family and you're not educating the children. And it's just, you know, poverty and misery and constant toil is no good for people. And it doesn't help them physically or mentally. And so that's all he was saying. He's not saying that they have some worldview that is universal to the proletariat that's corrupted. He's just saying it breaks your spirit. It breaks your mind.
First of all, this big sheet of blue rubber is made into the bottoms of the sneakers.
You mean that thing's all rubber?
It's all rubber, and it's going to the machine. And this machine forms the sheet into long, thick rubber strips.
They look like thick blue ribbons.
Oh, they do. Up, 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 and they're getting cooled by some water.
Oh, so they were hot before, now they're getting cool.
Cool, that's right. Next, the long strips are cut into shorter strips. Each will soon become the bottom of the sneaker. See, the shorter strips are coming out of the machine. There they are.
Sure doesn't look like the bottom of the sneaker.
There are very few fans installed in my current workshop. It's extremely hot inside. If they plan to install a new fan, then the others will tell us that we can only have one fan, or the fans that are there. In my working position, there's no wind at all. Can you imagine? I'm sitting there and dripping with sweat all day long. My body never gets dry.
I hear something saying, That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. All day long they're saying, ooh. Ah. Ooh.
I don't think the corruption actually is probably the best way to talk about it, but let's just take the alienation thing at its core. If you assume that alienation from labor and alienation from social processes is true to both the proletariat and the capitalist because he's, whether he realizes it or not, and Marx would say they probably don't, I don't know if he would say this, but he seems to imply that they don't always realize it. They are alienating people from their labor, and they are thus alienated from the labor process. They don't create things. Now, this has all kinds of problems for value theory that actually we're all still working out. But in the terms of this and this consciousness, this alienated consciousness would apply to both parties. If you think there's a possibility of an absolutely deracinated, unalienated consciousness that has perfect species being, whatever the hell that is, then it is corrupted. Now, you and I know, we may not know, but you and I contend that that sort of disalienated species being, even if we have a concept of species being, isn't particularly useful because we have no idea of knowing what it would even be. We can agree with that, right? So this kind of puts us in a double bind.
One thing that comes to mind immediately when you're talking about how the bourgeois or the capitalist is alienated from the world and from his own work, because he doesn't work, so from his own power, reminds me of is Hegel's Master and Slave dialect. And you can see it acted out in just everyday life, where you have a boss or an owner of a company who doesn't know how his own company was run, you know, and so you have someone who doesn't know how the day-to-day work is done, can't really do it, and is frustrated by how, in order for the job to happen, his underlings, the people he's supposed to be in control of, have to work around him or have to, you know, disobey him or you know, ignore him in order to get things done. But he still has, in the end, he still benefits from their insubordination in that moment, right? You know, and that's how the master works. The master says, do this for me. And, you know, but he can't possibly be the one to say, do it this way, because he doesn't know. He doesn't do the work. He has no experience of the work. So he can't be the telling you how to actually get things accomplished and doesn't know how to do it himself. So the slave is alienated totally differently. The slave is alienated because once their work is done, what she creates is turned against her.
Because what she creates is removed from her, the value that is created in the process because of the intermediary of a wage and thus the intermediary of money.
Yeah, I mean the easy way to think of it is like what she does is make whips for the master. You know, and she's very good at making whips for the master, and the master, you know, uses whips.
However, she can't opt out because if she opts out, she has no access to the means of production on her own, or at least not in a high enough skill to sustain herself.
But the difference between the Hegelian, this is what I wanted to get to. The difference between the Hegelian explanation of this and the Marxist one is in the Marxist one, there is a substance and a subject that's being produced through this process of exploitation. That's like economic.
And also, it's also historically specific, whereas the master-slave dialectic in Hegel manifests throughout history but is a universal concept.
Right. No, it's this is a historically specific value that's being produced. It's a subject of the society and the substance of society. Not exchange value, not use value, just value. That's, you know, the labor value.
Which is funny because it's something to think about a Marx. People who are familiar with the phenomenology think that Marx is pulling a lot off of the master-slave dialectic, and he probably is, but it's crucial to remember nowhere, even in his critiques of Hegel, does he bring it up directly at all. And reading Marx, and I've read a lot, I have never found a direct reference to the master-slave dialectic at all.
He may have made one, but he hasn't made it in Volume 1 of Capital.
Right, and he doesn't make it in the Communist Manifesto. He doesn't make it in the Critique of the Goethe Program. He doesn't make it in the Brumaire. I don't think he makes it in the Grandezza. In all the things that we're used to talking about Marx, you know, the main. So if he made it, it's like in a note somewhere, you know.
The master in Hegel is alienated from his own power because he doesn't work. The master under capitalism is alienated from his own power because he doesn't even have the power to determine what he wants. You know, he's in the service of an abstraction. The real subject is value and not the capitalist.
Right. So you're in a double bind, right? So even if you're a pure Hegelian, you could reconcile this with Hegel. But you're in a double bind in which Hegel didn't see. Because Hegel argues that the free cell of labor actually undoes the master-slave dialectic in the philosophy of right. Or it doesn't undo it, but is a sublation of it in a way that restores maximum freedom to both parties. Which is obviously what Marx thinks is nonsense.
I think a lot of the so-called Marxists, Leninists or Luxembourgists or whoever, are falling more on the side of Hegel than they are on Marx's side, that they keep thinking that it's going to be just a matter of getting consciousness, you know, without that material substance base. That
so to sort of get to this, to get this to bit a little bit deeper, and I think maybe to further your point where I don't disagree with you, but to make some distinctions. The Luxembourgists in particular were interested in long-term anthropology, all right? Something we see with a guy like David Graeber now. And perhaps they were the first people to go back and place proto-capitalist and primitive communist all over the place in history, okay? And this leads to stuff like under-consumptionism. It's one of the things that I point out. I pointed out before in a long argument with somebody that Luxembourg is closer to the Maoist reading of under-consumptionism, which not all Maoists share, but then a lot of people realize. Because what she argues is that there's a crisis of consumption because of production and people, you know, like the constrictions of the labor supply lead to this, that, and the other. And I would do, not in a bourgeois way like the Keynesians might argue, but in a radical way, is to get ourselves in a place where we can just produce enough for people to consume enough to eat up the surplus value. And that's how society would work. This is actually very close to Lenin's iron law of value, by the way. Not Lenin, Stalin's iron law of value and logic, which is if you generate enough surplus, you can reinvest that surplus. And despite, you know, we can maintain, you know, through, since everybody's exploited equally, and we all give the exploitation back to them, it's not really exploitation, even though it's still based off of getting surplus labor value out of labor. All right, so this is some high-level value theory. But Lenin's under-consumptionist theory – I mean, not Lenin's. Luxembourg's under-consumptionist theory is close to that. Ironically, Lenin made fun of this. Lenin thought this was kind of not going to work. Not to say that he necessarily was better. I mean, it's hard to – it's actually very hard to figure out what Lenin thought the ideal economic situation was other than just give everybody electricity and we'll figure it out. Because the NEP is kind of one way and what he says about Luxembourg is another. And then He definitely thinks declining rate of profits are real, but then he starts talking about super profits from imperialism. And so it's very convoluted. So on all this Third International stuff, basically everything starts to break down. And from that, you start seeing Lukács develop. Lukács is fascinating for this Hegelian side, because we've talked about how Lenin probably over-favored the science of logic, believe in historical inevitabilities, you know. Yeah, in a way that was actually kind of consistent with philosophy of right, sans the capitalism parts. Lukács goes the other way, starts favoring the phenomenology, critiques himself for this, actually, but does really dig himself down into, in all seriousness, workers' consciousness. He's the one, you know, that Adorno has the argument with about proletarian art, you know, that art should reflect proletarian concern and basically be populist, you know, triumphalism, et cetera, because that has to do with it. And his book, you know, History and Class Consciousness, really starts focusing on the creation of class consciousness. That comes out of Kautsky, too. I mean, that's not unheard of amongst left communists and social democrats. It was a focus for both. But as we're kind of getting into, if you start fetishizing consciousness, you get into this massive sort of cul-de-sac where you really can't explain how consciousness changes that isn't just stochastic, right? You know what I mean by stochastic? Just random. Because, you know, like, how do things shift this way? They haven't in the past. Nobody planned capitalism, for example, until capitalism was already pretty much existing. I mean, to some degree, it depends on whether or not you buy the liberal definition of capitalism as markets, which is a pretty crucial difference between Marxists and liberals, is what we think capitalism is. You know, we think capitalism is not markets. Markets exist in most historical time periods, and even existed in some socialist societies to some degree. Arguably, they would not exist in communism, but I don't really know what that would mean. But abstract value generated from exploitation is unique to capitalism, meaning things that people would call mercantilism in liberal ideology would still be considered capitalism for us, because they are about the exploitation of wage labor as well as colonialism and primitive accumulation.
If you're just talking about going somewhere and trading some goods that you brought with you for goods that they have, I'm not sure if that counts as...
Right. It requires manufacturing. It's not just trading. I think trading, once you have currency, is a universal, and currency is not the defining element of capitalism. It is necessary for it. Because without currency, you don't have a fetish object to really abstract value. But it's not the defining element of capitalism.
Well, here's my question. Why is it that, back to just this text, why is it that Hegel was such a big, important figure for Lukács and for the Marxist, the Western Marxists in general, whereas Capital and Marx was not? I mean, why weren't there debates over both, at least?
Well, some of it has to do with the fact that not all of Capital was released. Capital Volume 1 was. Capital Volume 2 and 3 kind of were, but they weren't, you know, it's hard to say, actually. A lot of the early texts also weren't. Critique of the Goethe Program was known about, but it wasn't really widely published. So a lot of stuff we have, they didn't have. So we do have that. That can explain some of it. But they had all the capital. The Russians definitely had it. The Germans also had it if they really wanted it. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Hegelianism was a universal language of both the Italian and the German communist, because it was a universal language of the Italian and German education system. and in different ways. You know, this book is focused a lot on Italy and Germany. They focus a lot on Russia, but in Russia in this time period, if you notice, Jacobi actually mainly talks about actual politics. You know, this group is playing with this group, who's writing an open letter to this group denouncing this group.
When you focus on all the political intrigue, what's missing is any attempt to change the base of the economy. I mean, it's all taking place on the level of who has political power, who has, you know, titles to land maybe, and who has the seats of power, you know, in government, or who's trying to have seats in power in revolutionary parties.
Maybe I have a thesis for you that I don't really have to argue. It's not argued in this book, but maybe something we could kind of play with. The focus on Hegel comes out of political determinism as opposed to economic determinism.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Right.
Because Hegel talks about, you know, the world spirit moving in politics. And specifically politics. That's why he gets so obsessed with, like, Napoleon. Right? Marx maybe, you know, doesn't really believe in the world spirit, but thinks that you can't separate out politics and economy, even though the liberals want to. I mean, if you want to talk about Marx's fundamental disagreement with all liberalism, and I mean all of it, all right? And it's important to remember, to be fair to liberals, Marx and Engels both started out as liberals. Engels was kind of a semi-general in the 1848 wars for the liberal side. But Marx's critique of liberalism can be focused down on one thing. There is no valid way because of class structure to separate economy from politics. You can't. There's no – and if you were going to favor one over the other, you would probably favor economy.
Yeah. See, that's where people get – they misread this all the time. When you say there's no valid way to separate economics from politics, most people will hear that and say, right. Every economic decision is a political one, you know. So
right, as opposed
so
to
if you're evicting someone's
decision, is an economic one.
It's like if you're evicting people from a tenement, it's not because they haven't paid their rent and you need to find people who can. It's because you don't like them. It's a political decision. You could choose otherwise, right? I mean, that's kind of the thinking. It's like. That's the political determinism, and it's basically saying that the economy doesn't exist. But it seems it's weirdly pervasive even in the Marxist left, and I'm just not quite sure why. Maybe it has to do with this bootstrap problem that people don't want
to
face.
I think it has to do with the bootstrap problem. I think it has to do with our own history. Our own history has been about either parliamentary victory or political revolution. We, so far as we know, have never been the main implementers of a true socioeconomic revolution in the complete sense. In Russia, there was a partial one. I will give the Russians this. All right? But it wasn't a complete one. We didn't do away with factory ownership. We didn't do away with division of labor. We didn't do most of the things that we explicitly promised, even for, like, the higher stages of socialism in the, you know – and Marx never spells out what his stages are, but and I know this is unpopular. He was a stagist. He thought that there was going to definitely be some in between stages. Now, I wouldn't call them transitional stages so much as just like this morphs into this, morphs into this, morphs into this, and this last thing won't have these traits.
So, do you think that if there's something to get out of this reading that? Some sort of deeper understanding of political determinism. I mean, I feel like I've already got that in my head, so maybe I'm imposing this on the text, but do you think that understanding the problems of political determinism might be helpful in this political moment where we've got, you know, the Paris attacks and Donald Trump running to be, I don't know, the head of reality TV America?
I think at the end of the day, we really don't have a good answer for a lot of it because we have so focused on the state for so long. We don't even know how to read our own history. You know, for example, you come away when we talk about these early separations between what would become left communism and what would become like Leninism, that we can agree with these or some of the problems that we saw in the end of the Second International and among the early Marxists. And we can say that they were legitimate. The one side was favoring one thing, the other side was favoring another. There are reasons why they were doing it. They were historical. That's clear. Once we get to the Third International, you and I both go, well, we can't really side with any of these. You know, this doesn't talk about 1968 or any of that deeply. But what we've essentially seen since then are various forms of the same problem crop up over and over again. And people think it goes back to 1968, but what you learn from this book is it goes back to at least 1918. So we literally are approaching, in 3 years, Doug, we've approached 100 years of the same damn problem. 100 years, 3 generations, no progress on this whatsoever.
Well, you know, the first step is admitting that you have a problem.